You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
I, Charles the Fourth, or is it the Third? Bloody
pen. We will strive for the de-artification of the
Let me put it to you, Justin Bieber.
Yes, you
if
can.
You win by one, you've won.
The phone went over the side.
It is time to draw a line.
I just think everyone should be sure.
What the fuck is going on?
Hello, I'm Mark Steele. Welcome to a very special edition of my podcast, where each week I ask the question, what the fuck is going on?
What the fuck is going on?
This week, I've been talking to my old mate, Robin Ince, who many people will know because you've seen his shows, we've read his books, and talking about the way that the mind works and all manner of sort of scientific things. And indeed, he does lots of shows about science with Brian Cox. And I was going to say I've been talking at some length with him. There's not really a way of talking with Robin that isn't at some length. I would imagine that when a bloke comes round his house to fix the boiler, he probably ends up leaving about 8 weeks later with 70 or 80 books, some of which are describing how quantum physics works, and the others, another one will be about the a biography of Sid James. So I was trying to talk to him about trying to be sort of a little bit rational in the modern world, when increasingly it seems to me there are more and more people who just delight in talking about things and looking at things from a point of view that isn't rational, that a disease that is clearly killing people doesn't exist, that the earth that is clearly sort of spherical is in fact straight, triangular, hexagonal, anything other than what all the evidence shows. So over the next, I don't know, however long it was, this is me and Robin Ince. Well, a couple of times now I've been able to say I've got an expert with me who can tell me what the fuck is going on, and I've actually been able to mean it. Most weeks I go, oh Christ, this poor bastard, he knows less than I do.
The Dawkins episode you did, I was amazed at how much stuff he was making up.
He makes it all up. Anyway, I was going to say, I was going to do that old joke and go, sadly this week we're back to normal, but Robin Ince, knowing what the fuck is going on. Now, marvellously, for a chat about rational thought, which is what we're going to have, we're starting this about 3 hours late because you couldn't log on to the
Well, I
website.
Was caught in one of those those loops where I was being told by the specific system you use to capture your soul and voice, as we know, it always says you need to update Chrome. So you update Chrome and then you sign in. It says you need to update Chrome. Now, of course, there is a possibility that Google Chrome is updating at such speed now that by the time I've downloaded it, it takes 1 minute, 37, it's updated again. So that's the problem, is I can never quite get to that new level of technology.
No, I think it's just that it's a bastard. And I think it's the most annoying thing in the history of the universe is when you've just want to get, and it, no, but you must download this important update. And it's not important to me, is it? It's important to you that we've downloaded number 47.234 of your fucking shitty, stupid system that some twat in fucking San Francisco has devised, so that bloody now that it means that your bloody alchemy fucking whatnot ratios fucking three. And it's so annoying. If you'd had these in the 12th century, the calmest Benedictine monk who had gone out to live in Lindisfarne and just spent his days praying and growing radishes would be going, fucking shitty, fucking twatty, fucking poxy, fucking apple. Until God went, calm down.
Well, it's not my fault.
Sir Caldius.
I've bloody drunk a load of Benedictine, haven't I? I'm off my tits. I'm just saying the full moon tonight is not working properly. Apparently, we've got to download Lunar Deity Yahweh 2.1.
Yeah. Yeah, it's evil. It is truly evil. Now, rational thought. This is something you're very keen on. Sometimes you have to be sort of prevented from going sideways. You start talking about rational thought and quantum physics and particles and such things. And then before you're a third of the way through the sentence, you're discussing a book you found by Robin Asquith.
Yeah.
About... Now,
I'm not able to be as linear as you, Mark. That's the thing.
Well, you see, I'm pretty well stuck. If I've got to do a radio show about Margate, and I went, do you know what? I'll tell you who went to Dreamland once. Eric Sykes. Now, here's a funny thing, and then that wouldn't work. But I mentioned Robin Asquith.
Can I just say there's a beautiful link there already? You mentioned Robin Asquith, who was in a film directed by Lindsay Anderson, two films directed by Lindsay Anderson, who one of his first documentary works was a documentary all about Dreamland in Margate. Welcome to Connections in My Head. Yeah.
Wow. Well, they would have gone. Of course, Eric Sykes would have gone to Margate because there's a house there that was owned by Hattie Jakes and John Le Mesurier, and they owned this house, and she was always giving him the runaround a little bit. I think she wasn't the easiest person to be with, and so it was mostly used for various people like Eric Sykes, who used to stay in it when they were playing at Margate.
See, even that is another good one. I was doing an event with Robin Asquith last weekend.
I know you were. That's why I mentioned him.
It was an impromptu event, the second one, because Mike Brearley didn't turn up because he'd been given the wrong information, right? So I said, Robin, why don't we do an event and I'll ask you all Mike Brearley's questions. And the final question I asked him was about Mike Brearley in his new book writes a lot about Wittgenstein. And so I thought, well, how can I do that? So I said, well, of course, Wittgenstein, when he died, said, it's been a wonderful life. Much like John Le Mesurier, who said, it's all been rather wonderful. And so that was the final question with Asquith. So this is what we're doing now.
Was Robin Asquith a big fan of Wittgenstein? We should just explain to people because
the Le Mesurier element was the thing that we managed to find by the similarities between Le Mesurier and Wittgenstein. And Wittgenstein, of course, was a huge fan of B movie westerns, as was Niels Bohr. And as you know, Niels Bohr actually wrote a paper on why the person who draws first in a western gunfight often dies.
Okay, now we should just explain that Wittgenstein was a philosopher, that Robin Asquith was an actor who became prominent in the 60s and 70s in Britain, mostly for being in films such as Confessions of a Window Cleaner that were sort of not, I don't know, philosophical would be stretching it. Mike Brearley was England cricket captain, a very thoughtful man who led England in one of their greatest ever series victories against Australia in 1981, in particular because he was, I think, training even at that time to be a psychotherapist. And sort of he had this, even though he wasn't the finest of players, he had this tremendous understanding of how to get the best out of each individual player. And so, you know, that's how that little triumvirate of that Brearley, Asquith, Wittgenstein triumvirate came about.
Well, in the end, also, we did cover the fact that Robin Asquith has showered with David Gower. So, you know, there was a lot. We found a lot of a
was that in Confessions of an England cricket captain?
Yeah.
Of a left-hand batsman.
Actually, it was one of those kind of knock-off versions. It was just called Who My Umpire? And all my bails have gone. But it was, yeah, really is. You're right. Well, I mean, I know we've talked about him before, I think. And remarkable. Every morning before a test game, he would go for psychotherapy himself.
Good Lord, I didn't know that.
So he would get up and his new book, which is it's called something like a biography of cricket and the mind, but you can clearly tell that his editor and publisher kept going, oh, could you just put in one story about cricket? Because the Henry James stuff's great, but just like a couple of Derek Randall anecdotes. But it's a brilliant, absolutely brilliant book, which I recommend everything. I'm sure you've read The Art of Captaincy, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I think that's the thing is, there are certain people, because I'm not a big sports fan, but I like a good story. And so though I might not watch that many cricket matches, I'm very happy to read books by John Arlott and Mike Brearley.
Well, yes, John Arlott similarly was a really important figure, really, because he was sort of one of the most prominent people in the early days, in the early 60s, against apartheid South Africa. And he was so entrenched in the BBC that they couldn't really tell him off, and he wouldn't. He was a brilliantly, one of those brilliantly old-fashioned, extremely militant liberals. So not particularly radical in his overall philosophy, but what he thought was right, he was going to absolutely battle for. And in particular, he brought over a player called Basil D'Oliveira, who couldn't play in South Africa because he was what was categorised as Cape-coloured. And that sort of, that in a sense, set up the whole, one of the most important battles that brought down apartheid, because at the end of that, D'Oliveira was then picked to play for England, wasn't allowed to go back to South Africa because it broke their laws about black and white people playing together. And so that was one of the things that set up the sporting boycott, which is one of the things that brought down apartheid.
Do you know what? This is what I love about our conversations. I was telling someone the other day, sometimes I think I must give Mark a quick call because I need to ask him something. And then I realise there's no such thing as a quick call. And that is very much on both sides. I feel that we're very much now, we're kind of in the Ronnie Corbett chair. Welcome to our discussion of rationalism. Now, of course, if I take you back to the 1950s when John Arlott first decided that he would not go to South Africa and go, and then right at the end we'll just go, anyway, be rational. Bye-bye.
Yes. Here's a thing. I know I've mentioned this before, because you were interviewing me once at the Latitude and you asked me about this. But in fact, this came from when I was doing one of the in-town shows about Basingstoke. And John Arlott is from Basingstoke. And I'm sadly not going to be able to do this quite the justice it deserves. But it is a story in which John Arlott talks about how he was invited back to his old school in Basingstoke because the headmaster was retiring. And he, by now, was quite a prominent chap. I think he wrote about wine in the newspapers. You know, people, oh, yes, John Arlott, tremendous chap, that sort of thing. And he was also a football writer as well as a cricket writer. He was quite well-known and stuff in the 50s. And they invited him back as a prominent alumni of this Basingstoke, whatever the school was called. And he stood up in front, they said this room was absolutely, can you imagine the hall, the old hall where all these sort of events would have taken place. And he stood up to do this sort of speech about what a grand person this headmaster had been over the years and was now retiring and how he'd be sadly missed. And he said, let me tell you a tale about the man who we are gathered here tonight to honour. And he told this story of about how when he'd been 11 or 12 years old, he'd been sent himself to the cloakroom. And when he got to the cloakroom, he was sort of getting whatever he had to get there. And the headmaster came in with a young boy. And John Arlott, the young John Arlott, seeing him come in, dived into a cupboard because he didn't want to get in trouble. Such was the sort of ferocious reputation of this headmaster. And he said, and then I saw the headmaster take down the pants of this young boy who started to quiver and cry. And the headmaster took his baton, can't remember what sort of ruler, I suppose, and proceeded to thrash the boy on the bare buttocks for a considerable length of time. And the boy continued to cry and plead for him to stop. But the headmaster just said, this is for your own good, that sort of thing, and continued to thrash him, leaving the boy in a state of great distress. And this was all said in this huge room where they were all gathered to pay homage to this chap. And John Arlott.
And I think he ended by saying, didn't he say something like, and this is the man we're here to celebrate
today? That's exactly
today.
It.
Because and there were a couple of...
The guy just got up and just very slowly left. But what a fantastic image that is.
Well, because I think, you might remember, because I think, as far as I remember, he talked about the run-up that the headmaster took. He took a run-up with the cane. And the first one obviously was very painful, but he said, oh, that wasn't proper.
I missed you slightly there.
And said, so that doesn't count. And it's, I mean, that's what, when you talk about that kind of militant liberal thing, I think about that. We're just coming up about the anniversary of my dad's death. He died last year. And one of the things, we often talked about John Arlott, and he loved cricket. And I always think that's exactly what my dad had. My dad had, he wasn't kind of, you know, technically left wing or anything like that, but he tremendously believed in fairness and justice.
Yes.
And he believed in doing the right thing and helping people. And I might have told you this story, because I don't know if we talked about this when we met in Hay last year, but when my dad, the company he worked for, which was ABC, if you know the ABC murders by Agatha Christie, he worked for the rail timetable people, do the air guides and all those things before the internet. And he found out that when they brought in a bonus scheme in his company, it didn't include the cleaners. or anyone who worked in a kitchen or anything like that. And he went straight to the head of the company and said, why doesn't it include the cleaners? And he went, they're just cleaners. And he said, but imagine coming into your office and it's in a right old state and your bin's all full and there's mess everywhere. He said, they're part of the company. They're part of the way things run. And it was like, and I think of my dad, you know, I think if you saw him, you would kind of go, oh, very much the tweed gentleman with the cravat and all that kind of thing. Not if you went into London, didn't wear a cravat in London. I remember once making the mistake of saying to a producer on a show, oh, if my dad's in the foyer, he'll be in a cravat. He went, I couldn't believe he said a cravat. I wouldn't come into London in a cravat. You wear a tie for London.
Is that right? But, you know, is that even the rules? How far in? Is it Greater London? Is it the M25? Is it the postcode?
Yeah, well, I think it's exactly the same. It was my dad's rules on the tie, which is where Sadiq Khan worked out where to put that system. So that was how they did it. But, you know, that belief in fairness is something that, and that, do you know what, that fits in, that genuinely does fit in with the rationalism thing, I think, which is, you know, to me, what is being rational is thinking about how many people does this help? How many people does this hinder? How many people, you know, what is the actual purpose? You know, when we're looking at a lot of the things, like I saw a thing today, someone put up something online with a picture of Grace Jones, Boy George, can't remember who else. And he said, go on, the 1980s, no one cared about, you know, the gender thing. They were saying quite a positive thing.
Yeah.
And then people went, oh, well, that's because in the 1980s, we didn't make a fuss like they make nowadays. And we just all got on with it. And I went, oh, well, we've forgotten about Section 28. We've forgotten about the kind of almost militarized homophobia during the AIDS crisis. Oh, no, we just all got on. Bloody idiots.
No, absolutely. And before that, of course, even, you know, the early days of Bowie. Yes, and of course, all those old-fashioned people, they didn't mind at all, did they? I think it's marvellous that the young people are dressing up in such ways, they said, and didn't at all go, you can't tell if it's a boy or a fucking girl.
Well, that's the history of it, isn't it? It started off with, some have got hair so long you don't know if it's a boy or a girl. Then you have Boy George, you're lucky they're called Boy, otherwise you wouldn't know, would you? And now we get to where we've got to now.
Yes. What the fuck is going on?
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Oh, what the fuck is going on?
So, but rational thought, yes, I think that's a very good end point, is what creates the greatest harmony, what's going to create the greatest common good, you might say, which is why I think that sometimes you have to leave irrational thought alone if it's not doing any harm. So, for example, you're talking about militant liberals, Christians, people who are militantly Christian could be amongst the most fervent of those people, can't they? I mean, I remember sort of doing a thing for a woman who was, I'm just trying to remember her name, Lindy. She was brilliantly eccentric. She lives up in Harrogate. And because there's the American base there, there's this American base that is America, right? You need an American passport to get in. It's got all these men with heels. Now it's got all these sort of huge golf ball things. You could see them for miles around. And it's an American listening thing, American base. And so every year, on American Independence Day, which happens to be my birthday, she organises an Independence from America Day. And I was going up there anyway, and I thought that'd be a brilliant place to have a birthday. And I went up there, and I had to speak at this thing outside, on the right by the fence, with all these angry American sort of people from the...
And George Washington pulled the trousers and pants of that young boy down, and he ran at him with a cane, and this is the man we're celebrating
today.
Yes,
but at least he was honest about it, because he couldn't tell a lie. But Alan Bennett turned up. It was like a most brilliant thing. It was like it for my birthday. Well, I don't want to prove of the some of the bases that had gone up in the military-industrial complex, and rather put me in mind of my auntie Miranda and all that, right? So it was brilliant, and it was pouring with rain. I do find that an umbrella in such situations is rather apposite, you might say. So it's all that, right? And and it was just delightful. But she was like very, very Christian. But to her mind, you know, Jesus would have been the person stood here outside this fence complaining about the Americans and their base. Now, having said that, right, we'll get back to that. In particular, if you have a little bit of a health issue, as I've had the last 8 months or so, then rationality is obviously pretty important. You know, if you turn up to UCLH and they're going, well, we've got someone here who's going to do a dance, and hopefully that might just sort of please the gods of tumours. I could live without that, really. Well, I couldn't live with that, you might say. So you're very much beholden to rational thought. And I've got a mate, a very close friend, who had cancer himself about 5 or 6 years ago, throat cancer. It was just six weeks of radiotherapy blasted him, and then he was fine. At the time, I remember thinking, oh my God, he's got cancer. That means he's going to die. And now I think, is that now I say to him, oh, your cancer wasn't even a cancer. It's more of a cold you had. But he warned me. He said, here's two things you'll get, and I would strongly advise you to just accept them with the kindness that they come with, even though it might be a bit annoying. You'll get people saying you're very brave, even though you've not done anything brave apart from get cancer. The second thing is you will get...
I don't know. You have done some brave things, though. You did that gig at the fire station with Joe Strummer that went horribly wrong.
That was brave. That was brave.
Sorry, I won't open that can of worms. No, sorry, I interrupted. I couldn't help. I just suddenly saw that.
Well, even that wasn't brave. It would have been brave if I'd known in advance it was going to go like that, and I'd still done it anyway. But it was... But the other thing he said, and I haven't had this actually, this hasn't happened to me hardly at all, a little bit, but is that you'll get lots of people going, oh, don't listen to their stuff about chemotherapy and radiotherapy and surgery and medicine. Stick a cactus up your arse and twist it to the left, you know, like the fucking ancient Palagonians used to do in fucking Peru, and none of them had cancer.
Oh, you've got to be careful on the cactus, because obviously you twist it the other way if you're in the northern hemisphere. So you've got the whole thing, yeah.
Exactly. That's what we're... Oh, no, now you're giving him cancer, you idiot.
You sped it up, you idiot.
That's how the Palagonian consultant got sacked from the... thrown out the Incas. So, you know, all that. And I didn't add much to that. But obviously in the world of health, the proliferation of the sort of irrational thought, particularly through COVID, it's been immense, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, just mentioning on the cancer thing, the Merseyside skeptics, I don't know if you've come across them, that they're... what I like about them is that there's some skeptics groups that can be a bit like, oh, some people believe in God. And they are not like that at all. They are very much about pragmatic human concerns. So they worry about, like, they did a big... piece of research onto kind of crooked cancer treatments.
All right.
And some of it is quite tragic. You know, people who've really believed that, you know, there was a young man, actually, Sean Walsh was his name. I remember it, obviously, because there's a comedian called Sean Walsh as well, musician called Sean Walsh. And I think it was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I might get that wrong. And he'd had it once before, and so he'd already had to be through quite a lot, so that when he got it again, he probably was thinking, I'd quite like to avoid all those horrible things I have to go through. And the trouble was that by the time, you know, his family were eventually saying, look, I don't think any of this thing you're being told is working, this supposed new age treatment is doing anything. And of course it was too late by then. It had gone too, and so it's that thing, I think, with, as you said right at the beginning, when it matters and when it doesn't matter. Like, you know, a lot of kind of general mystical beliefs, someone believing in God is, for instance, is not an issue to me. I wouldn't wish to I remember saying to an atheist once about if my mum, she's dead now, but, you know, said, you know, if she was dying, and she said, in fact, she once said to me, she was in a bit of a state, and she went, oh, and scientists have proved there's no heaven. She always wanted to believe there was an afterlife.
Yeah.
Because she lost her dad when she was young and stuff. And I just said to her, they don't do that kind of work, mum. Scientists haven't proved anything on that. Just like, and I remember an atheist friend going, no, but you've got to tell. And I went, why? To me, one of the delights of not having a dogmatic belief is if I do say to someone who feels that they need it, there's probably a God, I'm not then struck down by the British Humanist Association. Yeah, they might send me a stiff letter. But I think that bit of, to me, one of the most, again, it's a very pragmatic thing, which is this person believes something that I think is a little bit wonky, but you know what? It's quite fun and I can see the comfort and the delight in it. And this person believes something that enables their bigotry and means that they think they're superior and means that they believe that this whole group of people should be punished or whatever it might be, you know, whether that's through misogyny, whether that's about racism, different kind of faiths, whatever it might be. And in the same way, like you might go the flat earth, you know, it's just a silly old belief. But then you have the secondary problem that comes that if you believe something as enormous as believing that the Earth, despite the huge amount of evidence, and you can even test the curvature of the Earth if you've got a friend who lives, say, you know, a couple of hundred miles away from you, a couple of hundred miles north or whatever, and it's a sunny day for him and a sunny day for you, you can measure shadows at the same time, you know, and you can get some kind of sense. So it's not something where you're just taking that on trust. But that might just seem like fun and wonky, but of course, once you start believing that, that's a very easy entrance into then going, and I don't really believe we landed on the moon, and I don't really believe there was genocide in World War II or whatever it might be.
Now, that's a very good point, because there's a magazine, and have you come across this? I'm sure you have, called The Light. Are you familiar with these people?
Oh, yeah.
This is a group of people in sort of areas such as Stroud and Bexhill, and I'm not quite sure why those sorts of places, but they're quite big, and they've got a paper, and it seems to be sort of forming groups. The groups seem to be forming around this paper, and it is based. It came out of the lockdown and the rage of some people who suggested that the COVID was all made up, and you might say, well, that's of limited, you know, now that COVID isn't the major issue it once was, what does it matter? But amongst the conspiracies that they believe are that the Holocaust was, it didn't happen. And so now I'm not saying it's an easy job that everybody who doubts COVID is therefore believes that, but there is something that makes all of those things come together. And it's something I'm not sure I know the answer to this, but it used to be that if somebody believed, 9/11 was an inside job, for example, I used to think that that was almost an anti-establishment point of view that was irrational, right? That the idea that George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld had the capabilities of putting that together for all sorts of reasons. There are lots of reasons for believing that. That's utterly ridiculous. But it seemed to come from a left-wing point of view. Now it doesn't. Now the conspiracy theories all seem to head rightwards. They seem to be connected to people like Alex Jones, to people who think that the governments are imposing liberalism on us and they need to be overthrown for that reason.
Well, that's interesting you say, because I think about Naomi Wolf. Now, Naomi Wolf, when the second Bush president, George W. Bush, when he was president, she was very much, you would imagine, of the left, what she was dealing with. And now she's kind of swung. Yeah. And that's been an interesting, there's a brilliant book, you might have seen it, Naomi Klein wrote a book called Doppelganger. Yeah. And she said, you know, it didn't used to matter to me that I got confused for Naomi Wolf. It was a bit annoying sometimes. But now she's gone to where she's gone. And she talks about being in the, I think during some demonstration on Wall Street, that she's just in the restrooms. And she hears two women outside going, I'll tell you, he's a bloody idiot. That Naomi Klein, she hasn't got a clue. And they go on.
Yes, it's caused her a huge amount of distress, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, so just so you know. That's not me. That's Naomi Wolf you're thinking of. And they went, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. Yeah, you're right. It's a very interesting
just
book.
Just to intervene there for a moment, I can trump that, by the way.
Oh, go on.
There's one of the leading conspiracy theorists in this country, speaks at the demonstrations and all that, is called Mark Steele. Not just one name the same, but both the fucker, Geordie bloke.
Well, it's much harder, isn't it, when they're saying, I can't stand that Mark Steele, he's an absolute dick, and you come out and you go, no, you're thinking of Mark Steele, I'm Mark
Steele. Yeah, exactly. And he's up there. They're telling us that, I tell you who's ruining our fucking mains is our Fave G Must and all that. Ray! I never agreed with Mark Steele before. Don't know how he has time to work out what the bloody mobile phone signals are doing to our brains and then go to Basingstoke and Margate.
Yeah, his opinions on the goats in Linton and Lynmouth was something that I disagreed with. But now we've found... But it's, you're right, that it's an interesting... Because, I mean, we see Liz Truss doing this. We see a lot of kind of... Where they talk about this deep state.
Yes, yeah.
This deep, and you go, Jesus Christ, how much of the world do you have to run to be able to say that a couple of people on social media who occasionally say something that you define as woke have more power than the entire complex that, you know, and that's the bit that I think I find most terrifying.
Yes, exactly. The people who have run this country in recent years, from George Osborne, Boris Johnson, people of that ilk, David Cameron, there is a clique. It's fairly obvious to see where it's come from. They've come from a tiny layer of very privileged people, as they have done for hundreds of years. And they've run the country pretty much in their interests. The idea that there's something beyond that that's imposing everything on them, and you can tell they are because they've got 800 followers on Instagram. Is it?
I think that's where that's one of the most interesting things about when, you know, I know when this was first mentioned, you know, chatting to you about this, which is the speed in which, like, I look back to, say, 2008. And I remember us going, oh, my goodness, the creationists, very worried about the creationists who believe that it just took 6 days to make the earth or that it's 6,800 years is the whole history of the universe, whatever it might be. And now that kind of thinking, which was very much in the margins, but you had certain, I forget his name now, the bloke who ran the buses up in the northeast, who was, Vardy, was it, who was running academies and kind of.
Oh, yes, they were, quite. You've
got to teach both sides, yes, of the possibility. Yeah. And now that has spread across mainstream politics. And you can perpetually say, you know, to watch Trump at the moment, who, you know, to watch someone who is has acted in as many criminal ways as he appears to have acted, and to say the things that he said. And the horror is, it is true. That thing he said about, I could shoot someone in the middle of Times Square. Mm. And that's what we've got. And that's, I think, the bit that can seem most disheartening. But it's not as if it's the same human problem we've always had. It's the same time as when they used to, you know, hang women for being witches and all of those kind of things. It's that same. You just have to find more ways of trying to make people be a little bit more content about being doubtful, you know, of actually going. But because a lot of the, you know, when people say you've got to have an open mind, very often what they're actually saying is you've got to open up your mind. I'm then going to tell you exactly what to believe and then we're going to jam it shut again. Because a lot of the open-minded people are, or as they say they are, and what they're really saying is don't believe that, believe this instead.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes, 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 exactly. Like people say that about psychics or whatever, don't they? The trouble is, you've got an open, you know, you need to have an open mind when it comes to whether or not you believe that the woman appearing in the Swindon Arts Centre has actually got in touch with your aunt who died in 2005.
Because there was that one, was it in Dublin, where I think a whole audience wound up a psychic. It was like they'd all come together almost, and they were like, you know, it's a big theatre gig. And someone was saying, you know, can you tell me where my father is now? And, the psychic would start to go on this long journey through the, you know, ethereal afterlife. And then the man would say, oh, no, it's all right, he's come back now. He was just at the bar.
All right, here's a thing. Tell me what you reckon on this. This is a little aside. I was doing a show at a theatre one night in Southampton. And there were a nice lot of people there. And, you know, sort of sometimes you're in the dressing room there and you're sort of waiting to go on and there's the speakers in there. So you can hear I quite like that. You can hear what's going on in the auditorium, you know, in the main theatre, and you're sort of sat there and it gives me, and because I sort of have a little playlist of the songs that I've chosen as for people to listen to as they're sort of waiting, that I've chosen very carefully, that are got little nods to the what the show's about, and no one takes the blindest bit of notice. But I'm sort of sick. But I know, I think, all right, that song's on, so now I've got 12 minutes, you know, I should finish ironing my shirt in a minute, that sort of thing. And I can hear what's going on in there, but there must have been a microphone very close to these people in one particular bit. And I could hear them, their conversation very, very clearly. And they were, one of them was talking about a car. I was going to get this. Yeah, I don't know what one I'm going to get, really. I was sort of, you know, I've been looking at a Volkswagen Golf, but, you know, economically, of course, it pays. It's a little bit more expensive to buy, but, you know, it does 37 and a gallon and all that, sort of something like that. And I thought, oh, yeah. And then I thought to myself, Joe, it would be quite funny to go out and go, now, before I start the show, I've got a feeling, I've got a sense, I've got some spirits in the air. There's someone here who's thinking of buying a car, and they're considering a Volkswagen. I thought that, and then I thought, that's how they do it. That's how they do it. These fuckers, they're not in touch with the bloody afterlife at all, as I'd believed. They are. They've just got.
Well, it is that there's lots of different ways. I mean, like, one of the things that used to be regularly done by some of them was that they would very nicely put a bus on from the old people's home, a couple of buses. And, of course, there would be a couple of people sat on those buses who were in on it, and they just would get notes. Then you've got exactly what you said, the kind of the speakers thing. You've got people who've used earpieces in the past, and they'll be giving information. Someone like Doris Stokes, who was repeatedly found out, but it never – but I remember when what's his name? James Randi, when there was – I've forgotten the name now of the guy who he – on the Johnny Carson show, because Johnny Carson hated all that stuff, you know, the Uri Gellers and the psychics. You know, Johnny Carson had no time for that. And this guy, again, he had an earpiece in, and what they did was they worked out what the frequency would – was, and they listened to the earpiece. They could hear the instructions his wife was giving.
Oh, my word.
And when it was revealed on television, a lot of people were horrified by it, but the main letters they got in their mailbag were, oh, I was horrified to find out that man does all of these tricks. Do you know of a psychic healer who's more trustworthy? So that's, you know, that's the sad thing, which is the desire to believe means that sometimes you might actually stop believing in someone, but you just go, oh, well, that was, yeah, there's always a couple of bad apples in the psychic medium world.
And Yeah. But the same if God, if there was definitive proof there was no God. Oh, all right, then we'll pick another God.
Yeah, which I'd love.
Yeah. Well, we should go back to Zeus.
Oh, well, I think that's what you want is, because I like the old gods where they're all really flawed. Mm. They're not going, hello, I'm omnipotent and omniscient, right, which is what we kind of have now a lot in politics. You had people who just went, oh, he's very grumpy. He should not have turned into a swan and done that. That is, frankly, I think, pretty unpleasant there. That is, no, that's a very much a cancelable offence in terms of up on Mount Olympus. And I think that's a much more – I remember
– that's a great idea that Zeus has been cancelled.
Yeah.
No, he's not allowed. He's not, well, they don't want me anymore, do they? You know, all these modern gods, people preferred it, you know. In the old days, I don't know what the matter with them is, but oh, now you've got Sadiq Khan running Athens now, so.
Yeah, they've streamlined it down to just one god, but I don't think he'll be able to get everything done, to be quite honest. I mean, I think it's, but yeah, it's very, I'm sorry, I'm just going to go off on another tangent, and I'm sure we've had more than enough.
Was it going to involve Donald Pleasance?
No, it wasn't. But if you would like a little bit of Donald Pleasance work, I'd just like to give a shout out to a wonderful bookshop called The Jam Bookshop, which has just closed down, sadly. David Ziggy Green, who you might know from doing Seen and Heard in Private Eye.
Oh, yeah.
Ran a bookshop for a couple of years. It was really tough. And, you know, it didn't quite work in the end, but he put in so much effort in the last 3 weeks. He had so many people coming saying, thank you so much for introducing me. So I just wanted to kind of say, you know, independent bookshops, you know, a thing that I love.
Yes.
But the reason I mention him is he had a little corner of his shop, which was an art gallery, and he had a Columbo art gallery. And amongst the gallery figures were Donald Pleasance as a little action model from his appearance in Any Old Port in a Storm, which is many people's favourite Columbo episode, quite rightly too.
Oh, and he was in that. Okay. Excellent.
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen that one.
I'm not an expert on delineating all my separate Columbos.
I'll tell you what, I have a word with Carl Cooper. He'll be able to tell you.
I think it's a brilliant thing to be able to have the time in your life to watch one when it comes on.
Yeah.
And it's such rubbish. It's brilliant and rubbish. It's so absurd. It's like the top novelist in the country has murdered his best mate or something, who it turns out actually wrote one of his novels or something. And then in this utterly ridiculous way, he's found out, because he dragged him to the top of a lighthouse or something. And then when he's caught, he just goes, Columbo, you proved too clever for me, and just sort of meekly comes down and...
No, they never do. This shows how little you know about Columbo. And Carl Cooper and me are going to come round to your house. I mean, they're never meek. They're always...
They're stroppy up to a point, and then they go, Columbo, you've got me.
No, they don't. This is a typical, I would say, Stalinist rewriting of the far more Trotskyist work of Columbo. Columbo, undoubtedly, we're constantly looking at a critique of the class structure. More often than not, the person who has done the murder is rich and looks down on Columbo because seeing Columbo, believing Columbo is probably working class, they believe that he does not genetically have the mind that will be possible to... refute them and catch them out. And the fact that you've missed the class context and indeed some of the Marxist alienation that we see within both his Macintosh cigar and indeed within the nature of his car is something which is a terrible oversight.
I don't dispute any of that.
So but nonetheless,
when it comes to a discussion on rational thought, the idea that any murder story could unfold in the way that it does in a typical episode of Columbo is, I propose, preposterous. Regardless of its Marxist instinct concerning class conflict.
What the fuck is going on? Oh, what the fuck? Oh, what the fucking fuck is going on?
Here's the thing about class conflict. You know Robert Morley? We've discussed this before. Robert Morley, if you're of a certain age, you remember Robert Morley as being, I remember sort of seeing him on chat shows and stuff, this rather sort of classic, the sort of personification of the sort of class system, you might think, rather punch sorts.
Well, also my favourite character in Vincent Price's Theatre of Blood, Meredith Merridew with his poodles, my babies, where are my babies?
Exactly. It's in a parody of Titus Andronicus, I think, isn't it?
So that's
Robert Morley, and he's always in the sort of tie and stuff, and I was, you know, a big bald chap. And Robert Morley was a militant left winger. Did you know that? He led the equity branch on the march in 1972 or 1973 against the Conservative Party's Industrial Relations Act that was brought in to try and reduce the power of the trade unions. He led the equity banner on that march. He also, one of his big passions was horses, and he bought a racehorse and called it Class Struggle.
I love Morley. I think that's, I love those kind of, the shock as well of society that would, you know, again, it's a bit of going back to John LeMessurier. It's like the fact that John LeMessurier would always just smoke joints in public. Because he'd go, well, who's going to think John LeMessurier is having a joint in public? You know, all of that.
Is that true?
Kind of stuff, I think. Yeah. And when he used to do speeches in, where was it? It wasn't Hastings. I'm trying to think which seaside town it
probably
was.
Probably Margate.
It might be.
You have the house there. There's a plaque there.
Oh, well, there must be. And he'd always start off before they think, oh, good, John LeMessurier's going to die. And the first thing he says, what are we going to do about all the dog shit?
Splendid. I've also seen John going around the towns. Not only have I seen the place where he lived with Hattie Jakes in Margate, although, as I say, you know, the caveat being he didn't live there that much, and mostly they sort of let their mates, Tommy Cooper or whatever, stop there. But his family comes from Alderney, which I did an in-town show about sort of 7 or 8 years ago. And, there's a big sort of Le Mesurier house there in Alderney. And there aren't many houses in Alderney at all, but this is one of them. John Arlott also lived there.
Yeah.
He moved out there. Apparently he used to, and he and Botham moved out there for a while. And apparently John Arlott used to call him every morning at 9:05 in the morning and say, "Hello, Ian, come over and bring your thirst." And he'd open a bottle of wine at
He and Botham would get there very late because he had terrible problems with his legs at that point before they created some kind of system. He could just pop his feet in. Now he can walk much better. For those of you who watch daytime TV.
Oh, yes. The marvellous thing about podcasts, it's a young person. It's all for young people. It's the young person's medium. And this last 45 minutes has been exactly how to attract an audience of 22-year-olds. Donald Pleasants, Hattie Jakes, John Le Mesurier, Ian Botham's leg problems, all our ailments. Have you listened to what the fuck is going on and shit, man? It's like they're talking about all the people that we look up to and that. You get me?
And anyway, now here's a song by Ariana Grande. I found that one of the shows I did at the Edinburgh Festival last year was called Melons, and it was kind of a celebration. I sometimes mention you in it. It was a celebration of comedy and the delight. In fact, this, we're going back to the when we were talking about people going, "Oh God, the hair's so long." You don't know. I'm sure I've said to you before, but there used to be a daytime BBC every morning had a review of what had been on telly the night before, an hour and a half show, and you were on talking about Cabaret at Jongleurs.
Was it? Oh
yeah,
my God.
And, back in the moustache days and everything. Mm. And there was a bit where someone rang up and went, "Well, I was watching the show and there was someone called the Joan Collins Fan Club on. And frankly, myself and my son, we did not know if it was a boy or a girl." And you went, "Well, what did you say it was?" And I said, "Well, I just thought it was easiest to say it was a woman." "Well, it's you who's confusing your son then, right?" And really...
I don't remember that at all. John Collins Fan Club, for people who don't know, was Julian Clary.
That was his name. Brian Marshall, the producer of that show.
I don't have any memory of that at all.
But I talked about that. But what I was saying is, in Melons, I was talking about lots of the comedy I'd loved, lots of it. And what I found was interesting was I very often got quite a young audience as well as older people, and they didn't care that they didn't know the references, because what they enjoyed was someone who they thought, "God, he's so passionate about these things, and there's something that I love as much as he loved when he was 15 years old." And I think that's the thing, which is, I quite like the bit where you're not patronising an audience, that when you show that you love something, love, I think, can transcend the... It doesn't, obviously, television commissioners have no interest in that. But in terms of real life, I've quite often found, a 17-year-old came up to me and said, "I've never felt more seen." And I thought, fantastic. You know, I started on the goodies. So
now here's my question. I don't know the answer to this, about rational thinking.
Oh, not back to the subject of the program again.
It'd be like if Match of the Day, if after the first 35 seconds, Gary Lineker and Ian Wright stopped talking about Sheffield United versus Wolves and got on to a film, an early Stanley Kubrick film that they'd seen.
Yeah, or just going, "Yeah, I mean, I saw Saltburn, and I do understand, you know, it's been quite divisive, hasn't it?" Well, I mean, once you start looking again about the kind of the different films about the nature of class, we can go back to we can obviously go back much further. Look at The Kitchen.
When I want to watch something about that depicts the nature of class and Marxian philosophy, I watch Columbo as a rule.
Very good. He's getting better.
I've got to agree with you, Gary. I think the boy needs to come in more, watch the programmes from the start, try and accept the social philosophy behind it, and move on from there, because I don't think the way that he's looking at it at the moment, I don't think he's going to stay up. This must be very frustrating. It's very frustrating if you're not sort of a scientist or something. If you are somebody who has studied the laws of physics and you sort of know the way that light bends through the sort of contours of space according to Einstein and such, and then you come across someone going, "The Earth's flat and there's you know, there's no such thing as apples, and you know, Ipswich, it's actually in France. They're just fucking with their mind. All that. That must be absolutely infuriating, isn't it? How do you deal with that?
I think there's a thing, isn't there, which is you work out who has been misled into a position and who dogmatically believes in that position. You know, as we know, the internet is filled with people who've monetized their kind of, you know, bad thinking, bigoted thinking. You know, you look at, like, I put up a thing about Jordan Peterson the other day, and I found this lovely book. I don't know if I've ever shown it to you. I got it from
I read that article.
Oh, man, it's just like this beautiful book of 12 reasons 12 things, why Jordan Peterson is definitely wrong. And it's just no words in it, just loads of pictures of monkeys and apes with their mouths open. It's fantastic, simple way of doing it. And I got, you know, lots of kind of abuse, whatever you want to call it, doesn't really matter. And I thought, these are people who have to believe. They have to believe in a certainty, whether it's in the certainty of Jordan Peterson's supposed brilliance. And as we know, I talked to Jeremy Dyson about this a few years ago. He said, in terms of Jungian archetypes in storytelling, Jordan Peterson's very strong. In terms of climate change, considerably weaker. You know, and I see, you know, that I think it's most depressing sometimes when you have people who are seen as academic pinups and have now started to believe that they must know about everything. And I certainly used to find that with journalists when they were writing, columnists writing about climate change, was they would kind of think, well, I actually got a 2-1 in Old English for my study of Beowulf at Caius College. So I think I can understand the nature of the environment and the atmosphere, actually. And you go, no, they're very different things, Beowulf and that. And I think we're kind of... You know, the physicist Richard Feynman talks about the fact you can't anymore, you know, you can only really be an expert in a very, very small area because now we have so much information. And that bit of just working out who to have a conversation with, because, you know, quite often I'll have a conversation. If it's, do you know what, there's a lovely line from I've forgotten his name, I keep doing this, a guy who wrote a wonderful book called Begin Again, which is how James Baldwin, basically the great writer James Baldwin, got him through the Trump years as a black academic. You know, it was an existential anxiety that happened when Trump won. And one thing he said to me when I was talking to him is, he said, the thing is, when I go on to TV shows, if I'm invited on to talk about something like critical race theory, which, of course, has been hugely misrepresented, absolute nonsense, you know, by initially the right and then quite, you know, quite broadly in the media. He said, I always have to pretend that the person I'm arguing with is arguing in good faith. And right. I think that's one of the most important things, which is very often, and we saw this a huge amount during the kind of anti-vax stuff, is a lot of those people are not arguing in good faith. A lot of the people with the biggest platforms are arguing to whatever will monetize their, you know, I remember saying something that when Lawrence Fox tried to set fire to the LGBT pride flag in his back garden, and I put up something, I don't know, reasonably frivolous, and I got a message from him saying, well, perhaps we should debate then. And I was like, well, no, there's no point. There's no, of no interest in talking to Lawrence Fox, because he has nothing interesting to say. It's a bit like when Slavoj Žižek was asked to write a book about Donald Trump. He said no. He said, because there's nothing interesting to write in the end.
Now, I'm not sure about that, because I think that Donald Trump is, if you're sort of analysing what he says, now let's have a look at whether or not bleach can actually cure COVID. That's obviously ridiculous. Let's have a look at whether he was actually in Sweden on the day he said he was. No, it appears he wasn't, and so on. But the phenomenon of Trump, why has Trump won over, you know, at least 60 million people in America? That's worth writing a book about, isn't
it? That's not about writing about Donald Trump. That's writing about the psychology that leads to that, I think. Because Donald Trump himself, I think, is not a very interesting person. I think he's a bombastic narcissist, brought up in privilege, who cannot understand anyone not praising or worshipping him and cannot be wrong. And that's kind of the whole psychological story of him. And it turns out we've lived at a time where to be like that can in certain cultures be really, you know, you can maximize that. And but why he could become president is an interesting question. Donald Trump, I don't think, is an interesting human.
Yeah, okay, okay. But I think then I think to try and deal with the problem of someone like Donald Trump or anyone else, you know, Boris Johnson, who was pretty irrational. I mean, he was, if you were looking for the flaws in what he said, you didn't have to look very hard. It was, you know, he would contradict himself from one day to the next. It was utter gibberish and so on.
But again, he's not interesting as a human being, but it's interesting that it was possible for, like, I'm sure I might have mentioned the story in Fintan O'Toole's Heroic Failure, which is all about very much the English psychology that would lead to Brexit, this kind of, you know, mixture of us going, well, we're the greatest nation in the world, and everyone's so unfair to us, you know, the typical kind of bully mode. And he tells the story of, you know, Boris Johnson when he was trying to get, or maybe did succeed, you know, to get the Conservative nomination for Henley. And the speech he gave, you may well know about this, was to say, my wife recently had a child and they brought her toast, but she was asleep. So I ate the toast. And then when she woke up, she was annoyed that there was no toast. And I went to get some more. And they said, you can't have any more toast. And that's what's wrong with our health system. As opposed to, I am a greedy fat man who took what was not his, and when caught out, could not get out of it with the current system we have.
Now, why doesn't Keir Starmer say that? Oh, this has been marvellous. I could honestly sit like this all day.
Well, we should do it more often. I like it.
Let's do it every week.
Face to face. Let's do it in person. I loved, by the way, can I just say, the things that you've been putting up during your treatment and the stuff about how disgusting you started to find people eating when it was so much easier to merely syringe puree into your stomach. And you thought, look at the past there. People opening and closing their mouth and masticating. I thought that was beautifully done.
Thank you. No, it did. There was a whole period. So I had that peg put. First of all, it was in my nose. So I look like a surrealist painting of an elephant with this sort of this big tube coming out of me nose. And that lasted about 2 weeks, I think, something like that, before the I could get an appointment for them to put a thing into my stomach. So for people who don't know what happens, I certainly didn't know this before. It's called a peg, stands for something Latin that, you know, I don't know what it is. But it's like having an earring that they puncture the stomach, and then they put this sort of tube in there, and then you syringe all this stuff in, so you don't taste anything. So unless you burp it up or sick it up, which of course you do once you're having radiotherapy and chemotherapy. So yeah, you just, but then because I lost all desire for food, and I just, yeah, I think I wrote that it was like watching an Attenborough thing, a wildlife thing, where a bird was being sick into the mouth of its young. And you sort of think, well, I can see why the bird's doing that, but that's fucking disgusting. Birds really need to sort that out. And it was like that, yeah. I'm still a bit like that. The peg's gone now, so I can eat, but I just don't, you know, the taste buds are all mashed up. And I've got through three big glasses of water while I've been sitting here, that sort of thing. Because of my saliva glands. Who would have thought a little thing like saliva? If you were asked to name the 100 most important things in your body, would saliva get in there?
Oh, I reckon if we get to 100, yeah, definitely.
Where would it be? 81?
Yeah, I think it would be, yeah, it would be 81. It would be disappointed that it was 81. And it would be furious about what was in the top 10.
Yeah, I can't believe the fucking liver.
Who the bloody hell's voting for toenails? This, I'll tell you what, putting this out to vote by the public was an absolute disaster.
Channel 4 show, the 100 most important body parts.
I'll tell you what, if we don't get that job and Griff Rhys-Jones does, I'm going to be furious.
Oh, heart always wins. Heart, heart, heart. It's just got, I mean, how can we compete? You know, they've got all the PR. But kidney, you can have one of them out. Give it away. Don't even miss it. Still comes in at 4. But see, anyway, saliva. Oh, I'm never going to be rude about saliva again.
And that was very much, because when I first saw you, I think it was probably the Chuckle Club 86, and that whole routine, 25 minutes. And then just as you're about to get to the punchline with mucus, you know, Eugene Cheese came on and started singing Minnie the Moocher. But it's a very specific reference for some of you, but for those who've got it, congratulations.
Donald Pleasance was far too mainstream. We're now talking about a bloke who ran a comedy club in 1986.
And for much of his life,
we're probably the only people left alive who went to that.
That was one of my favourite things. I'm sure you've had it because you like doing voices as well. A review I got in Edinburgh which said, it does mimicry of an enormous number of people, and some of whom none of the audience will know. But I did see them compare that one gig they did, and it sounded just like him. You know, the unconsciousness.
Robin Ince, thank you for illuminating us. Not only what the fuck is going on, but what to do with all the people who really think that it's all been made up and that the earth is triangular. Oh, yeah. What you got coming up? You must have at least 4 books, 17 gigs. And
I am working
a laundrette you've recently opened.
Well, we mentioned Margate. I'm popping down to the Margate Fringe, the Tom
Thumb
Theatre. It's the end of May. I think it's May Bank Holiday. I think I'm doing the Monday Bank Holiday there. And then I'm off to Bath Comedy Festival. I'm going to do the show Melons, which I've only done a couple of times, which has been an absolute, apart from Edinburgh, which has been an absolute joy. And then the paperback of my book, Bibliomaniac is out now and all that kind of stuff. And hopefully, I'm hoping that Carl Cooper and I are able to do Reality Tunnel again. I haven't heard from the BBC, but I loved seeing, just to give a where to, mate, which is, for those listeners who don't know, Carl Cooper also produces In Town, Mark's fantastic show, and Carl, they won Best Comedy.
Yeah, quite right. It's brilliant. It's a sort of semi-improvised chat in a northern taxis.
Yeah, and it's Joe Enright, Barbara Nice, fantastic, and of course because it's won the prize of best comedy. I think about 2 months after it's just been cancelled. So, but it's really worth listening to and an absolute joy. So let me. There we go. I'm going to plug someone else's work.
Oh, you great philanthropist, you. I think if we've learnt one thing, it's that we should all go and look at Columbo from a Trotskyist perspective.
And any one of them directed by Patrick McGoohan, because they're fantastic, because you can see that him and Falk really got on and they dick around.
He was in one of them, wasn't he? He was the murderer in one of them.
He's in 4. He's in 4 and he directed some of them, and in one of them he does his prisoner line, "Be seeing you."
Oh.
Yeah.
Mr. Robin Ince. Thank you so much for listening to this special Incian edition of my podcast. If you've liked it, rate it. And if you can be bothered, write a review. If you can't be bothered, then write it in a physics paper. Go and spend 8 or 9 years getting a degree in physics and just slip the review in there surreptitiously. If there is anything at all that you think I should be finding out what the fuck is going on with it, please send me a message on Twitter at WTFisGoingOnPod, and we will look at every message that you send. If you would like to become a WTF supporter and get early access to ad-free, that's ad-free, nothing's ad-free in the modern world, extended versions for as little as £2 a month, please visit our Patreon page. What the Fuck Is Going On was hosted by me, Mark Steele, with my guest Robin Ince. The music was by Willie Dowling. It was produced by Pete Sinclair and Mike Benwell at Carousel Studios. What the Fuck Is Going On was brought to you by WTF Productions.